Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's time for a birding update from our regular guest, Bill Volkert. Bill, a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked for at Horican Marsh for over 27 years, I believe, and he's been watching birds for well over 40 years. A great time of year for bird watching. So what birds are you seeing in your area? What questions do you have about maybe locating birds? Join the conversation. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Bill has a new book out called Journey of a Thousand Lifers, and we'll talk with him about that book as well and maybe how you can get a copy of it. Bill Volkert, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Well, we've had a cool spring, pretty cool spring. Is that affecting bird migration in the state?
Yeah, it definitely is. Birds move with the weather. And we had, of course, a very severe winter, which meant the ice lasted for quite a while into early spring. But as soon as that thawed on the wetlands and on the lakes, the waterfowl migration picked up very quickly. And so, in a sense, we were pretty much on schedule as we got into mid-April. And for southern Wisconsin, our ducks and geese, the migrant Canada geese, stick around till about the third week of April. And then as the northern lakes open up, they depart. And so that was pretty much on schedule. But for the last 10 days, 2 weeks, we've had not just a cool and damp temperature, but a lot of north wind. And that's held back the migration. And right now we're behind schedule. Birds are starting to show up, but the reports are just a few individuals here and there. The big waves are still waiting. As a lot of people commonly say, the birds will come with the warm weather. And it's not just the warm weather, but it's that southerly wind that brings them in. And so the north wind has literally been holding them back. They ride those winds. Now, this weekend is starting to look good. I don't know what the winds are going to do. They normally don't report that more than about 24 hours in advance, but it's a good warm-up. That's an indication. We're going to see a warm front. And if we have southerly winds, south-southwesterly winds overnight, because most of our birds migrate at night, they'll be making up for lost time. They'll be coming in, and this first week of May is usually the arrival of a lot of birds.
Yeah.
And as I say, we're a little behind schedule, so the floodgates could open. So everyone's anticipating this.
I'm hoping, Saturday I'll be at the listener appreciation event. By the way, if you'd like to come as you listen to the show and Bill and I talk, we'll be at the Havenwood State Forest from 10 to noon. And Bill, I'm sure going to hear some birds there.
Oh, yes. It's an interesting urban green space. I actually helped in the early planning for the land development and management of Haven Woods. So I worked out some preliminary management plans for the property when it was first acquired it was a transfer to DNR. And what's interesting is it's a fairly large size property in an urban green space. So birds that are migrating up near to the Lake Michigan shore, if they're looking for a place to drop down, that is a real magnet for them. So certainly the common birds of the forest edge and shrubs and fields will be there. A good chance for the robins, the cardinals, chickadees, the song sparrows. Those are all expected, but you also never know, especially this time of year, what else may be dropping in. And so it's a great birding area.
Well, Larry Mueller will be dropping in.
Yeah. Sure.
from 10 to noon. So that's going to be kind of a fun aspect, is to hear what and see the birds that are there along with our WPR listeners.
Yeah, I'm sure your listening session's indoors, but take a few minutes as you come and go just to step outside and see what's in the neighborhood.
Well, we're talking about birds. Jonna in London has a question or comment for us. Hi, Jonna.
Hello. I have the Drumlin bike trail in my backyard, and we have a nice variety of birds. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, a Boy Scout project was a list of all the birds that they found on the bike path, so we can check them off as we see them.
Oh, very good.
But that's wonderful. But my question is, I've had orioles for years. I recognize the pairs. I've seen fledglings. Well, the last couple of years, robins have been invading my jelly, and I just have it on a swinging dish, and it was quite comical, but obviously it's the same robins because now they just land and eat, but they chase away my orioles.
Yeah.
So I'm,
yeah,
I'm wondering it sounds how like I you can discourage them.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got, as you indicated, very likely the same returning robin that's got this a real appetite for the jelly. Now, robins, we always think of them as eating worms. A lot of different invertebrates are a common summer food for them and their nestlings. And as we get into fall, they switch over to berries. That's a very abundant food for them before they head out. And so grape jelly and wild fruits, the berries, is probably not all that different. And like a lot of birds, you will have an individual or two that'll get a particular appetite for something. So it's not, say, off the menu for a robin. It's not common for them. But you've got somebody who certainly found has got a sweet tooth and is enjoying it. Have you ever tried putting out more than one feeder? Put a little distance between the two. See if the robin can be
That's
kept busy at one.
This year.
Yeah, see if you can keep him busy on one and give a chance for the orioles on another one. Don't put them too close together because he may be going back and forth and trying to dominate both of those. See if that doesn't help.
Yeah. Give it a shot, Jonna. Thank you.
At least give them a chance to come in.
Yeah, thanks for calling. My oriole, as I mentioned the other day, usually arrives on the 4th of May. So
the first week of May is usually the time. I have heard reports of a few orioles, just a few, and even an orchard oriole that was sighted around Lake Geneva area recently. But this is the week they should be coming in, and really, this first, 2nd of May, we should be hearing a few more reports of people around the state with the early ones. I think they're all being held back. So let's see what happens this weekend.
Yeah, that's for sure. Jane in Suamico, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I am one of those people who got hooked this last year on eBird, and I use Merlin Bird ID to mm-hmm. try to help identify birds, and it's terrifically helpful.
Oh, good.
And, I'd love to have other people know about those as well.
Mm-hmm.
I have two birds that I've been seeing that I don't know what they are, and I'm hoping you can help me ID them.
Well, we'll certainly give it a try.
Great. One is smaller than a chickadee. It's a soft gray, except for a single white bar on the wings. And mm-hmm. I couldn't see the beak or the underbelly, and it's one of those that flits on the tree twigs.
Yeah, it doesn't sit still very much, does he?
Flies off.
Okay, if you look real closely, you'll see a little white ring around the eye as well. It's not real prominent because the bird is tiny. They're so small, they actually do make chickadees look big. These are the kinglets. And we have two species of kinglets, the golden-crowned and ruby-crowned kinglet. Golden-crowned kinglets are a little bit earlier migrants. For my backyard, they moved out about a week or more ago. Right now, as we get into late April and first part of May, the ruby-crowned kinglets are coming through. And, yeah, they're jumpy little birds. They're in a family of what are called old-world warblers. So the name warbler, what was applied for those small songbirds in Europe, they belong to really the European family of birds.
Yeah.
And they'll actually be around for a little while here and heading north. They'll be nesting in Canada, some of them all the way up to the edge of the tree line for the little guy.
Incredible, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And the other one is also small, maybe chickadee-sized. Mm-hmm. It has a long tail. And I just saw it flying away from me, and its back and wings were a complete solid rufous color, that bright rusty brown. And it's unusual that it would have been a solid color like that.
Rufous at this time of year, I think of fox sparrow. It's a large sparrow, though.
Yeah,
it's one of the largest sparrows we have.
This is not a ground dweller. We have fox sparrows.
Oh, you do? Okay.
It didn't seem like
that
one.
All right.
Yeah.
Rufous in the wing and back.
Boy. We'll ponder that one,
yeah,
Jane.
Maybe some other listeners have an idea, too.
Yeah,
we'll see. We'll consider that.
We'll consider it. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had, speaking of ID, Scott sent a photo and wondered if you could ID that particular bird.
Yes, and we're just talking about
it. We were just talking about it, exactly.
This is golden crown kinglet. Now, I mentioned ruby crown kinglet has the white ring around the eye. And the females are just sort of a bland, grayish, slight olive color to it. The male has a ruby on its crown, but they hide it. They cover that up with the feathers, except when they get a little excited and when they sing, they'll just raise that up, and it's a brilliant red. Now, the golden crown kinglet, as its name implies, has golden there. It's not quite as well hidden. You'll see the stripe. Even on the female, you'll see a yellowish, not a deep gold yellow.
Yeah.
And they've got a stripe running back from the eye, and then also dark bar across the side of the head with a gold in the middle. And that's how you distinguish them. Look at those face markings. Those are the two kinglets, and they're tiny birds.
Well, it was kind of funny to see that photo pop up as you were describing the bird. Aaron in Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Aaron.
My binocular is broke, and I'm wondering if you would recommend a certain type of binoculars to view birds. But also, you know, I like to see things way in the distance. Is there one that can do, you know, both?
Okay. Choosing binoculars can be pretty involved. I usually tell people, get something that really fits and works for you and is within your budget. A couple of hints, though. First of all, the little compacts are nice to carry in your pocket, but a lot of those are only 6 power, so it's a little bit low for birds at a distance. The other problem is you get into the 10 power or even they're getting 12 and 15 power with image stabilizer. Sure, you magnify things, but it can be really hard to find something up in the trees because your field of view gets focused down. Yeah, it's really tight. And so I usually recommend a 7 or 8 power, 10 at the most. Those are really good range. Now, do you get what are called the poro prism or rift prism? In other words, the ones where you've got the barrels that come out, or are they straight? That's a matter of just your own feel. How do they fit in your hand? And, of course, everybody's got a little different size hands and grip. So you want to go to a place where you can really try some out.
Yeah, I wouldn't order and those online.
Yeah, that gets a little tricky. And then for as far as budget, don't spend too little. Of course, also don't spend too much, especially if you're a beginner. I mean, you can get binoculars over $2,000. If you're going to use them just casually, that might be overpriced. But you also have to watch that you don't get something that just doesn't have quite the quality optics. And a few things you want to look for is the quality of the lens polish and the coatings. So you're looking straight through the lenses, but what you want to do if you test them, move them to the side, look to the very edge and see how clear that glass is right to the edge. Because what will happen is as you stare at a bird long enough and try to look at it, if the glass is not really good and well ground and kind of a precision manufactured, your eyes will be doing very simple focusing to compensate for it, and you'll get eye fatigue. In other words, after a while, you'll actually see people put binoculars down and rub their eyes because staring at them and you trying to compensate for poor glass really makes a problem. And that is where the difference is in the higher end binoculars. So do buy something that is, you know, you can get a decent pair for $200, $275. Those are pretty good to start with. You can go over $2,000 if you really are so inclined. Yeah, right. Go top end. So it's a broad range, but I would suggest go to a place where you have something that you can try out. You can really see what works for you. Also, I would tend to avoid some of the sporting goods stores or hardware stores. The reason for that is they usually carry just one or two brands. You don't get a lot of choice there. So go to somebody who's got a real nice line of optics and see what's out there and try them yourself. Best hint I can give you.
There you go, Aaron. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Net, taking a look at spring bird migration today with Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller, and we have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or go ahead and email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Rusty in Marshall next. Hi, Rusty.
Hi.
Hello.
I've lived in this house about 25 years. It's in a rural subdivision. It's on a 1-acre wooded lot. I've been feeding birds ever since I've lived here. And I always get the usuals and, the chickadees and cardinals and blue jays and nuthatches. Nuthatches have always been white-breasted nuthatches. And this year, I'm getting red-breasted nuthatches.
Oh, well, good.
And I wonder if they occupy the same territory, or they're moving one species to the other in and out of whatever?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Yeah, well, we do have those two species of nuthatches in Wisconsin. There's another one out west and one in the southeastern United States, the pygmy and brown-headed nuthatch. But of the white and red-breasted nuthatch, the white-breasted is a little bit larger and is associated with deciduous forests, where the red-breasted nuthatch is really doing the same job in the coniferous forests. So that's how they sort themselves out by the nesting season. White-breasted nuthatch tends to be, for the most part, a year-round resident. Red-breasted nuthatches do migrate. And so this time of year, you see a little shuffle. Some of the slower ones are still coming north. I had one show up for one day at my feeder last week, real briefly. And there's some places in the Baraboo Hills, the Kettle Moraine, where you've got some mature pine stands where we do have some nesting populations. Otherwise, we tend to associate them with more northern Wisconsin. But in the south, as a migrant, they can show up at any time, and they'll stop in for a little while. And I think that's really the joy of watching birds around your backyard or local area. It's always nice to see the regulars, and you never know what else will drop in.
Thank you, Rusty. Appreciate it. Scott in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I saw a bird this spring, maybe a month ago or so. A little bigger, about the size of maybe those larger sparrows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while, but it was, as I recall, predominantly gray with maybe some black around the wing area. But it had a couple of very pronounced features. It had a black mark behind its eyes and an extremely large beak, maybe an inch long on this bird, and it killed, it's a predator of some kind, it killed a house finch or something on the ground. It's not a hawk beak, it looks more like a crow beak, and that type of proportion related to the head. Very large, heavy beak.
Did it take off with it?
It did.
Okay.
Stick it on a fence, maybe?
Yeah.
It killed it on the ground, and then it flew off with it. The other birds were trying to keep it away.
Right.
And it flew off. I've never seen one before. I haven't been able to find anything like it in the books.
Take a look under shrike.
Yeah, it's a shrike for almost.
There
for
are
sure.
two species of shrikes in Wisconsin. Loggerhead shrike is on the threatened species list. It's more common in the southern and western states. We used to have a fair population in Wisconsin many years ago. Nowadays, they report about 3 to 5 nesting pair in the whole state. But northern shrike, they come out of Canada, out of the spruce forests in wintertime. So it's a winter visitor here. And it's always a bird that's quite a nomad. They move around quite a bit. And to actually find one in wintertime, you got to do a little bit of searching and just get lucky. So, an interesting bird. It's really more of a songbird that has a predatory nature. And Larry had mentioned about impaling its prey on barbed wire fence or big thorns because they haven't got the talons like hawks and owls to hold their prey down and kill it that way. So they kill it with the beak, they'll impale it and then strip it that way because the beak is the real killing machine, but they have only got small perching feet, so not a lot of strength there.
Yeah.
So a great sight, and right now they're starting to depart. I don't think in southern Wisconsin there's going to be that many remaining anymore. Maybe one late straggler if you're lucky. Northern Wisconsin, they're probably still seeing some up there. But it is a winter visitor for us. Great sighting.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Appreciate the call. Edie and Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I had heard that you could go to Point Pelee or Pelee Point.
Mm-hmm.
In Ontario and see all kinds of warblers when they come through about Mother's Day.
Right.
But you got to have a passport and it's a long ways.
You don't have to go that far.
Good. Tell me where to go.
Okay. Well, Point Pelee, what makes it really such a draw is it's a little peninsula that juts out into Lake Erie. And so the birds, they flock up against that shoreline. They kind of, like a traffic jam, they stack up there before they fly across the lake. And so it's become quite a popular little area. But the warblers are migrating through the whole eastern United States. These are birds of the forest edge for the most part. And when they get here, it's really the thrill for the bird watchers because in Wisconsin, we'll have about 35 species. So it can be a real challenge to sort them all out. We have a number of them that will nest in Wisconsin, some of them more exclusively in the North Woods, others throughout the South. And some of them are migratory. They're heading up to Canada. But in May, we'll get the whole bunch here. And you're calling out a baraboo. Well, I'll tell you, one of the best places for you to go is the Baraboo Hills. It is a nice forested area. There's a lot of warblers that will be visiting the dense forests. And you're also sitting in an area where it's one of the few places to find Louisiana water thrush and also the worm-eating warbler as common nesting species. Other good places, along the Mississippi, it's a real corridor for birds to be moving up, and a lot of bird watchers flock out to Wyalusing State Park. It's not only a great stopover for birds, but along the Mississippi corridor, we also get some of the warblers that are a little further south of Wisconsin for their normal nesting range that extend a little farther north there. So Prothonotary warbler, Kentucky warbler, those are some real unusual ones that tend to frequent there more often. Anywhere else around the state, it can be your backyard, local park, the Lake Michigan shore. Any place with a nice stand of trees is always worth looking for them. The warblers will be coming this weekend. It'll be the first 3 weeks in May is usually the real peak of warbler migration. To me, when I start hearing the voices of the Tennessee warbler tells me that we're at the peak. They're all in at that point. It's the real peak. And the real challenge for warblers is this. Coming in May, it's also when the trees are starting to bud out. Now, we've had a lot of rain, a lot of moisture in the soil, and we get a little heat, and those leaves are going to start popping very quickly. And most of our warblers are only about 4 to 4 inches in length, and they like to sit in the middle and upper part of the trees. As those leaves emerge, they disappear from sight real quickly. So every year, it's always that challenge. How fast will the birds get here, and when will these leaves open up that will start to hide a lot of these birds from view? But keep your eyes open. Get some binoculars because these are going to be little birds, little specks you'll be seeing jumping into treetops, and you got to take a close look at them to sort them all out. Have fun.
Have fun, Edie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we've have some recordings, and Dave Potratz has some up for us. And it's, you know, we've been talking about the songs and everything. Let's hear our first one. Bard, we'll go with that first. Yeah, there
I wanted
go.
To give people a little hint on how they can start to learn birds by their voice. And this is one of the more common ones. And I know for a lot of people who are just getting into bird watching, it's hard enough to sort them all out by sight and to be able to identify them. And if you get around some of the experts, here they're identifying them by their voice. And learning their songs can really be an incredible aid, especially, again, for a lot of these songbirds when they get masked by all the dense vegetation. The barred owl is one of the easiest ones for us to recognize, and a lot of the bird watchers use little phrases to help to kind of remember the voice and the rhythm. And that was, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? So that's a very simple little phrase to help us remember the voice.
Yep.
And a lot of them have that, and we'll find some other examples here.
Here's another one. Let's see what Dave's got up.
That's white-throated sparrow. And white-throated sparrow is arriving now in southern Wisconsin. They love the thickets. They'll be in people's backyards and along the forest edges. For those in northern Wisconsin and into Canada, they'll be nesting in especially the cedar and tamarack swamps. Southern Wisconsin, for the most part, they're a migratory population, but they'll be singing as they're coming through. And a little phrase for that. There's two of them that people commonly use. Oh, sweet Canada, 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 or Old Sam Peabody, Peabody, Peabody. It's somehow when you hear that voice, what is it that you can kind of put a little bit of a reminder to it? Sweet Canada, Canada, Canada.
Yeah.
So these are all foreign voices to our ears, so we need some sort of a little mechanism of how do we describe that, define that, and something that's going to help us remember who's making what sound out there.
Let's take another call and go to LaVon in Roberts, Wisconsin. Hi, LaVon.
Hi. This is a little bit off the subject, but I have a pair of Swift 8.5x44 binoculars, and I picked them up, and it's the beginning of the migration season, and the eyepiece fell out, the right eyepiece.
Yes.
And I know that I have had some binoculars repaired at Eagle Optics in Madison in the past, and they're out of business now. Do you have any place that you could suggest that I get a hold of so I can get my binoculars fixed?
Well, Eagle Optics has gone to all online sales, so they've closed the actual walk-in store. They're not as such out of business. A lot of binoculars, even Eagle Optics, what they'll do is send them to the manufacturer. They won't necessarily repair them right there. If you buy a little bit better binocular, a lot of them come with lifetime warranties. So I would get in touch with Swift and see what they would recommend, and perhaps you can send those in. The problem is right now, early May, you want them this weekend.
Yeah, you want them right now.
And it's going to take a little while to be able to make contact, get the address, box them up, ship them there, and then have them work on them and send them back. And unfortunately, migration will probably be over before you get those back. But, yeah, check with the manufacturer directly. That would be the best you can do, because those are the ones who are going to be able to repair them or tell you if they can be repaired.
There you go, LaVon. Thank you so much for calling. And Bridget in Seymour, Wisconsin. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, and I am so glad you just put me on, because I just pulled into my driveway, and as I did, this huge pileated woodpecker just landed in one of my trees.
Oh, fun. That's always nice to see.
I've been sitting here about 5 minutes watching him, and he has barely moved. So, he just took off. Maybe he's got so much feeder in the backyard. But I did want to say that I have had, over the last couple of years, both nuthatches year-round. Mm-hmm. But we feed peanuts shelled and in the shell. And those little guys, they just prefer the shell. They don't want to work too hard for it.
Mm-hmm. And we think of nuthatches as being, in large part, insectivores. They'll be going up and down the sides of the trees and the branches looking for any insects lodged in there. But they come quite regularly to the feeders, and I will see them oftentimes grab one big sunflower seed, fly away, they wedge it into the tree, and then they'll hammer on that and extract it. Or they'll actually cache them there. And I think that's kind of a waste of their time, because I'm going to fill the feeder again over and over. But nature's taught them that if there's an abundant food source, take that and hide a few of those, and just in case there's some lean times.
Bridget, I bet you get a bunch of blue jays.
Yeah, they do that in my backyard, too. But now the blue jays have learned where all the woodpeckers are stashing their stuff.
Got a little drama going on there.
Oh, they like nuts. They like peanuts, for sure.
Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thank you very much. Janet in Sauk Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I'll second the two woodpecker kinds in our backyard, too, but we do have numerous mature pine trees, and we also have breeding pairs of brown creepers, too, here.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Another thing, I have had a varied thrush since November.
Oh,
here.
Good for you.
And so when do they go away?
It should be fairly shortly.
He go away, I should say.
Yeah, varied thrush is a bird of the northwestern United States. So you get out to Oregon, Washington, you're really getting the heart of their range. But they tend to have this unusual wandering come the wintertime. And every so often we'll have someone to come in all the way to Wisconsin. And, of course, when the word gets out, it's certainly a sought-after bird for the bird watchers here in the state. So a varied thrush, yeah, he seems a little off course. It's not unusual, though, for him to show up in Wisconsin. There's always, I think most year, you can probably say there's one or two sightings of them in the state.
Mm-hmm.
We may skip a year with not much of a report, but it's not infrequent. And it's a winter visitor. I would suspect that within the next 2 weeks here, as the warm weather brings other birds in, he'll get back to where he belongs for the nesting season. So, yeah, really nice to enjoy that for the wintertime. Lucky you.
Yeah, lucky you, Jana. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments or maybe an experience to share as we talk about spring bird migration. with our guest, Bill Volkert. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Mitch in Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for picking up here. Question I had is I've been doing audio recording, and you know, with the springtime, you guys mentioned and you played a couple of tracks and the call recognizations you did a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if there's any resources for someone like me who's not so much bird watching, but just trying to get those unique Wisconsin birds that come through, like the locations or about the call, things like that, that people could check out.
So information to actually for you to record them?
Or,
yeah. Or just anyone in general looking for that info, you know, like
okay.
You're talking about.
Well, the electronics, of course, are really changing. I had a good friend who was doing that. He put together the CD of the songs of the birds of Nicaragua. He used a shotgun mic and just a small little pocket digital recorder. The old way was with the bigger parabolic mics. The real trick is to get a bird that's singing without a lot of background sounds. Either other birds singing as well or traffic noise, things like that. And, yeah, you see a lot of people are out there as avidly recording birds as those who may be photographing them or just watching them. There's a lot of collections of bird songs. The biggest one is Cornell University, the Macaulay Library. It's the Library of Animal Sounds. They're collecting things from all over the world and not just birds. Somebody earlier, one of our callers mentioned Merlin. That's a nice app that people use to identify birds. There's just a wealth of resources out there for people. And as we've been talking about bird vocalization, the real challenge for somebody just starting to listen to birds is once you actually open your ears and listen to what's out there, you realize it's a very noisy natural world and there's just so many different sounds. And how do you start to sort them out and identify them and remember them? And that gets to be, of course, the challenge.
Yeah, a big challenge for sure. But
it's a great learning process.
Yeah, you can always go online to, if you know the birds that are in your area, you can go to Cornell Lab, for example, mm-hmm. for free. You can call up Robin or Blue.
Yeah, just go on their website, and it's all part of the life history information of identification, the range, and some of the vocalizations of the birds. Another thing I would really suggest for people, if you're interested in trying to learn about birds, how to identify them, which ones are in your area and just getting started, or if you want to learn some of the songs, go with an expert. Go with somebody who really knows those birds. Go to one of the nature centers. Check their spring calendars. A lot of spring bird hikes, morning warbler hikes, variety of things going on all over the state. And it's a real good shortcut to go with somebody who can actually point these things out rather than sitting there with a book or trying to find them online of something that you heard and hoping to sort that all out yourself.
It really is a lot of fun, too. I've done it a few times with an expert. And you're right. When you're out there, oftentimes you're hearing five or six or more different species talking at the same time. But an expert can say, all right, now listen for, you know.
Right. Yep. And even help you, once you hear it over and again, how they remember it and give you a little hint.
Yeah.
And for myself, my wife and I, we travel for our bird watching. And I know the birds of Wisconsin and North America, but when I get to some foreign place, I'm always listening, and I'm just dumbfounded by a lot of these unusual voices and sounds. So I seek out a local guide and expert, and it's really amazing to go with somebody who knows the birds of that area and can show you something that you probably wouldn't find on your own very easily.
Yeah. So there you go, Mitch. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And Jean in Viroqua, your turn next. Hi, Jean.
Hi there. Oh, thank you so much. I am new to Viroqua. Wonderful, wonderful birds in this area. But there is a bird that I've noticed for the last week, 2 weeks maybe. It looks like a crow. It looks just like a crow, except that its wings and its tail are like this silvery gray. And do we just have a really old, unusual crow, or am I looking at something else?
And is this the size of a crow?
Yep.
So in all other respects, it looks like a crow?
Yep, exactly.
Just silvery gray. Well, there is a slight sheen on the wings of the bird, and I'm wondering if it might not be just a little bit of the play of the light of the bird that you're seeing. I mean, if in all other respects, it looks like a crow. There aren't a lot of other things of uniform color in that size. But, for example, a sandhill crane, sometimes they can look a very rich brownish color, a dull gray, or even sort of whitish. And there have been a number of people who have misidentified or confused the sandhill crane with the very whitish whooping crane. And it can be just the light, as well as the age of the bird. I can play with the plumage a little bit. So I'm guessing a little bit, but perhaps it's just simply the lighting. And maybe on a really overcast day, that color may look a little different. You also notice that, especially with these gloomy days we've had with the blue jays. The blue sometimes can, with bright sunlight, can get really washed out, and they look very grayish, dull, with just a hint of blue. Other times they come in by your feeder, and they just look a deep, rich, almost electric blue. And you wonder if that's the same bird, but that's a reflected light. It's not really a pigment. So the sheen on the bird feathers, or especially any of the blues that reflect the light, there can be a lot of variation in what we see.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling, Gene. Appreciate your call. And Dave Potratz has another song for us to listen to. So let's...
Think witchity, witchity, witchity.
Yeah.
It's one of the vocalizations of the common yellowthroat, which is a warbler. And again, we're trying to find some way to describe the rhythm of the bird and a little bit of the quality of the voice. The real problem is that, as I mentioned earlier, these are all foreign sounds. And it's, to me, just like learning a foreign language. And if anybody has ever tried to learn a foreign language, it takes work, it takes practice, and a lot of repetition. I oftentimes think of the movies where you'd see somebody get themselves the recordings, put on the headphones, go to sleep, and the next morning they're completely fluent in Japanese.
No.
Does not happen. I've studied Russian. I've been working on Spanish for years, and to really even get conversant with it, much less fluent, it takes a lot of practice. So here's a hint I would really give anybody who's interested in trying to get a little bit of the familiarity with bird songs. Start with the easy ones, which are the ones you're going to hear over and again, and start with the ones right around your house, a local park, or in your backyard. And something that you're going to hear throughout the summer or throughout at least the springtime now. And one thing I notice for a lot of people is if I point out a bird and say, oh, that was a cardinal, oftentimes people, oh, yeah, I did hear that. And what I've recognized is I heard it, I listened to it, and I identified it. They heard it, but kind of pass it off. And once I mention it, then it registers.
Yeah.
You've got to make that jump. And what I tell people is this. You hear a bird singing in your backyard. You're curious. It sounds beautiful. As you just wonder what it is. Get out and look at it. Actually watch that bird throw its head back. Listen to the song. And just take a little time. Then turn around and just listen to that. And if you hear that, go, okay, that was song sparrow. Or that was white-throated sparrow. And just every time he sings, don't just shrug it off, but every time you hear that, I just have to make that very conscious. That's white-throated sparrow, white-throated sparrow. Then ask yourself, okay, if I hear that later today or tomorrow, how will I know it? Is there a hint in the book, a phrase or something that helps me? Maybe you can go on a bird hike and somebody will give you a little bit of a clue of what they use. And some of them will work better for some people than others. I've had some people say, oh, this is how I remember it. And it's, nope, doesn't work for me. On the other hand, I've also had people say, this is how I remember that bird. And boy, that just nails it. And I never forget.
Yeah.
For example, the ruby-crowned kinglet. Many years ago, somebody said, oh, it's a what? See, look at me, look at me, look at me. And that just absolutely sorts out this bubbly, rattling, fast little voice of theirs that really you have a hard time sometimes figuring out. How do we define that in our own minds?
Now, how does tell us again how you define or how you figure out that it's a yellowthroat, a common yellowthroat?
Common yellowthroat, the most familiar phrase people use for that is a witchity, 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 or sometimes Wichita. But...
Oh. All right, there it is.
Yeah, and he also has a little variation in the voices. So this is a little bit more whistled than sometimes, sometimes a little bit more raspy, but he has that witchity, witchity, witchity.
Witchity, witchity, witchity. Well,
the problem with that, some of that is I remember years ago people coming on my hikes every spring, and the next spring they come by, Horicon, we always had a lot of yellow throats, and they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's the witchity bird. But now, who is it that says that? So it's one thing to remember the phrase, it's another remember who uses that phrase. But it takes practice, like anything else, like a foreign language. You'll get it down if you just practice.
Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking spring bird migration here on the Ideas Network. Talking spring migration today with our guest, Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Wanted to mention again, we talked about earlier about my visit at Havenwood State Forest on Saturday, and it's our WPR's Listener Appreciation Event in Milwaukee. It's an open house from 10 to noon at Havenwood State Forest. So if you have the time, I'd love to meet you and talk with you, and maybe we'll hear some birds while we're at it as well. So that's this Saturday. Then a week from tomorrow, next week, Friday, join us for a live broadcast of Garden Talk from the 17th Annual Bayfield and Bloom Garden Expo. 17 years I've been going up there. It's a lot of fun. But you can learn more about both those events. Just go to WPR.org/presents, and you'll find out all about it. And Saturday, 10 to noon at Havenwood State Forest in Milwaukee. We will take some more calls now, and let's go to Kim and Ladysmith next. Hi, Kim.
Hi. How's everybody doing?
Good. Appreciate Fantastic. Your call.
Yeah. I'm looking out my back kitchen window. It's a huge window, and I feed the birds back there, and I'm like, oh, here's a warbler, and I'm looking it up. Okay, yellow-rumped warbler. And it's an Audubon warbler, and they're supposed to be way out west, but it's not a myrtle.
Well,
it's really cool.
Okay, what happened was a number of years ago, they recognized that the myrtle warbler, which is the eastern population of this bird, and the western Audubon's warbler were occasionally interbreeding where they meet. And the biologists thought that, well, if they're regularly interbreeding, maybe what we really have is one species with an eastern and western race. So when I started bird watching, I saw myrtle warblers in Wisconsin. I'd have to travel out west to see the Audubon's warbler. I had two birds on my list. Well, what they did was reclassify them, or what we call lumping them. I lost one bird off my list. They're now both the same species with an eastern and western race. And we have the myrtle warbler yellow-rumped race here in the eastern United States. Now, actually, there's been some discussion. Maybe there's enough genetic differences between them. Maybe we should split them again. And this is a frustration for bird watchers. And it leaves the perennial question of how many kinds of birds are there in the world? Well, it depends on who you ask. We're not always agreed on where we draw those lines in the variation of some of these populations of birds. But yes, we have the eastern race of the yellow rump warbler, what used to be called myrtle warbler. It is the earliest of our warbler migrants. They may show up sometime in early April, certainly by the middle of the month. They're here. They're out of sync by like 3 weeks from all the other warblers. For those in far northern Wisconsin, they'll be nesting there. In southern Wisconsin, it's the most abundant of our migrant warblers, and it can be a little challenging when the other warblers show up and you've got all these yellow rumps mixed in with them and trying to sort them out and essentially dismiss those because you've seen enough of those to try to look for the rare ones. And it's not unusual in warbler watching to get out and find 12, 15, 20 species in a morning. So that's what bird watchers are really looking forward to in the next couple of weeks is this big wave of them. But, yeah, the yellow-rump warbler is certainly very common and out of sync, as I say, in migration because he comes much sooner than everyone else.
There you go, Kim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give George and Adams a chance to join in. Hi, George.
Hi. Yesterday I got home. And I went to my backyard about this time of day, and I could hear something. It sounded like something breathing in the backyard, kind of like a crow cawing. Ha! Ah, ah. Ha! like something that was labored breathing. Then all of a sudden I noticed this owl take off out of a tree, and where that owl took off from a tree, there was a squirrel sitting there. And when the owl left, the squirrel just sat there and never left. I wonder if that owl didn't have that squirrel held down and punctured its lung or something.
Or maybe just a really unusual vocalization of the squirrel that you normally don't hear, except when he's under distress.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, it's a special kind of a cry that birds and mammals will give in that kind of a predatory or distress situation, and we normally don't hear that. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, that's probably what it was. Boy, I can remember hearing a baby rabbit that a hawk took.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, my goodness me.
So,
what a sound. And I saw that, you know, the hawk was in the air with a rabbit, and the rabbit was not happy.
I've had people describe it as a tortured baby out there.
Yeah.
Just this screeching and crying. And you don't expect that out of a rabbit.
But you hear it.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for sure. Yeah. Thanks again for calling, George. Appreciate it. Jim and Troy up next. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a tufted titmouse on my 50 acres here, and they can empty a in-the-shell peanut feeder in about 6 hours.
Getting to be expensive, isn't it?
And that led me to I have both in-the-shell and out-of-the-shell peanuts just because I like to see different birds there. But the question I have is about how far away do birds come to feeders? I have this image that they're within a couple football fields of my feeders. Mm-hmm. And I've asked other people, and I don't get a very good answer. Is there research on that? Do we know?
Yeah, there's been some research and looking at birds, and in fact, those people who do the bird banding, the capturing and marking of birds for studies, one of them is what's called the MAPS program, Monitoring Avian Populations to Survival, and the protocol for that is you've got to be at least 100 yards. And suggest to be even more from any feeders. So in other words, what you're getting are birds that are sort of moving on their own rather than being concentrated to a feeder. Now, for different species, they also have different home ranges. So chickadees, they don't wander a heck of a lot. So I would think that you're probably luring them in from, say, that football field around you 100 yards or so or a little more. Other birds like blue jays may come in from a little greater distance. So each of them does have a little bit of a different habit of how far they'll go for food. And, of course, in wintertime, we also have the birds that are moving around and flocking, particularly among the finches. They may be hitting a feeder in big numbers and then pick up and go and find another feeder and a different flock replacing them as nomads. So it does vary quite a bit. But for stationary populations, and especially as we get into summer with feeding, the summer nesting season of feeding birds at that time, they're probably fairly local and, say, several hundred yards away. Most of them on average, yeah.
Yeah, there we go, Jim. Thank you. Camille in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two quick questions.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 30-foot Colorado spruce that has a fungal infection. The arborists keep telling me that it needs to be sprayed. I keep asking them, what does that spray do to the birds that are living in there? They have no answer. Can you help me on that one? Also, I hung up a bird feeder, one of those sock feeders that you can pick up at the hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see a lot of birds on there. I hung it up in the winter. Is it possible that that seed has gone bad and they don't want to eat it? Is there any way I can tell?
That's Niger seed that you have in that sock feeder, I'm assuming?
Beg your pardon?
That's Niger seed or thistle seed, as it's called, in the sock?
Yeah.
That is the one seed that will actually spoil. And we've mentioned this in the past. It's not unusual that for the Niger seed that you can have it out there and the birds just are not hitting it. It will spoil. It may already be in the store that it just sat on the shelf too long or something of how it was stored or sometimes in how you're storing around home. I don't buy it in big bags. I never get a 50-pound bag of Niger just in case it goes. It's too much to throw out. But I tend to rotate my stock, get the smaller bags. And if I've got it out there and I filled all the other feeders several times and the Niger seed is still sitting there week after week, I assume it's just gone bad. I dump it and I'll get a different bag of it. So, yeah, that can spoil.
And did we get?
Oh, as far as what they're spraying, it depends on just what the chemical even is. Yeah. I mean, we know things like DDT and, you know, others can be extremely harmful for birds. Others tend to have less impact. Well, all chemicals can persist or move through the environment. Some have a little longer life out there, and some can be certainly more harmful than others. So I couldn't give you a blanket statement.
What you need to do in that case is, since they don't know themselves, ask them the name of the chemical that they're using, and then you can go online and look up.
Take a look at what are some of the side effects and possible hazards for it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Terry and Roberts wonders if it's too late to put up a bluebird house, and if not, how high should it go?
Okay, bluebird houses, this is the time. They're coming in. They're starting to settle in a bit, and if they haven't already, they will be looking for a nesting site. So, yes, get it out there. And how high? You can put them up, say, 5 feet high. The big thing is to have a predator guard so the raccoons can't climb up there. And you can do that either with a shield, like an aluminum cone, or I use 4-inch PVC piping that hangs loosely around it. It makes it difficult for the raccoons to climb that post and get in and fish around in the nest to try to take anything.
Near the edge of some trees?
You don't want it too close to the trees. The chickadees and the wrens will get in there more likely. My best suggestion is go on the website of the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, BRAW, and check out. They've got great hints of how to set them up where, how to monitor them and take care of them, and help to boost the population of bluebirds.
And how to make it so they're not owl feeders.
Right. Yeah.
Our guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He'll be with us till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Bill. So you stay with us. Do you know the bird that's making that song? Maybe you do. We'll talk about that bird and a whole lot of other birds as well with our guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in as we talk about bird migration, spring bird migration. And Bill, what did we just hear?
Very common bird for, I think, a lot of people should know that voice, the killdeer. And I selected that one because this shows not only how easy it is to remember the sound, but we gave it its name. He's actually saying killdeer, or at least that's the closest that I think most people agree on, that vocalization.
And let's hear it again.
Sounds like killdeer. Easy enough to remember.
Yeah.
And so many birds really got their name that way. Chickadee, whippoorwill, the phoebe, peewee. We can go down a long list of birds. So recognizing bird sounds, people have for a long time tried to put something to them. Some are easier than others to try to define that way, and others are just so diagnostic, we actually name them that.
Bill, I mentioned at the start of the show that you have a book out. It's called Journey of a Thousand Lifers, and I have it in front of me. It's a beautiful book with lots of great color photos, but tell us about the book.
This is actually a little bit of a birding adventure from a trip that my wife and I took a few years back. This was our trip of a lifetime, absolutely. It was a 7.5-month around-the-world birdwatching trip. And so for people who are interested in a little bit of travel adventures and certainly those interested in a little bit of the exotic birding, it is a little bit of a summary then of the places we went, some of the sights that we saw, the birds that we pursued, and some of our experiences. And the title, Journey of a Thousand Lifers, well, for bird watchers, a lifer or life species is a bird you've never seen before. And for us, it literally was a trip of a thousand lifers. There was just over 1,000 birds that we found on that trip that we'd never seen before in our life.
That's amazing.
So it was really quite the adventure for us, traveling through southern Africa, Madagascar, India, Southeast Asia to Borneo, and in search of some of the wildest places and its great wildlife and some wonderful adventures and experiences along the way. And that's really been always my take on bird watching. If you follow the birds, they'll take you to some of the most beautiful places out there, and you never know what other experiences you'll have along the way.
How are copies of the book?
I have copies available on my website. easy to remember. It's BillVolkert.com. I'm not really that well set up for online sales, so unfortunately at this point I have to take checks. Mm-hmm. But people can just contact me by email. That's right on the website. And I'm just beginning to even distribute this and make it available. And as we talked earlier about it, this is actually a book I wasn't planning on writing. I got talked into it because as I've given the presentations on it, everybody was asking, are you ever going to write a book on this? So I decided to take them up on that. And I just came out with that in the last few months.
And you give talks. You have a lot of talks, don't you?
Oh, yes. I don't say solicit or advertise for it, but I've been on the circuit for so many years. People keep asking me to come back. I was just last week down at Lake Geneva for their Audubon group. I've been doing that for I don't know how many years down there. Next Tuesday, Urban Ecology Center. Then later in May.
The Urban Ecology Center at?
In Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee.
Yes. Yep. We'll be speaking there. They've got, it's part of their Brew City Bird Festival. I'll be one of the presenters actually speaking on this particular trip. And then the same presentation I'll be giving at the birding school at Beaver Creek Reserve outside of Eau Claire. And then other presentations. I've got a bit of a calendar on the website of where I've been invited to. So, anybody's interested, I'll speak Volkert, on whatever.
BillVolkert.com. .com. There you go. BillVolkert.com.
That's if you can spell my name, you can find me.
Pretty easy to spell.
Yeah.
V-O-L-K-E-R-T. There you go. Let's take some more calls here. Alec in Beaver Dam has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Alec.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
We had a mallard duck nest in a tree in our backyard last year, and it sat on its eggs and had chicks, and we were hoping to catch them leaving the nest. But unfortunately, we missed it. Mm-hmm. Now, the same duck, I think, it certainly looks the same, has come back this year and is sitting in the same spot in the same tree, nesting again. And I know that the ducklings apparently leave the nest within 10 hours, but I'm wondering if there's a specific time of day that we should be keeping an eye open for them. Is it, do they push them out in the morning, the afternoon, or is it just a random time?
It may be a little random, more commonly in the morning, so that they've got the day
usually
to get
early
out and
in the morning.
Get out and feed right away. And so, and you said in a tree, that's a little unusual for mallard. Wood duck and hooded merganser is not unusual. Those are cavity nesters. Mallards have been known to nest in some unusual places, but usually are on the ground. But anyway, typical of the birds in general, they tend to lay an egg every day or every 2 days and will wait until the entire clutch is complete, and then they begin to incubate, so they all develop at the same time. And we basically have two different strategies. Ducks, geese, turkeys, a lot of birds have what we call precocial young. In other words, they hatch out, they're fully feathered, and as soon as they are all out of the egg and dried up and fluffed up, they leave that nest not to come back, and the parents will then lead them to where the food is and watch for safety. Others, like our songbirds, are technically referred to as altricial young. In other words, these are the premature, naked, blind birds that have to develop in the nest before they fledge. And so the parents aren't really pushing them out. They will call to them, but as soon as they see everybody's hatched out and ready to go, they'll lead them out. And as Larry mentioned, yeah, usually it's very early in the morning. And that is so as soon as they're out, they've got to start finding food. They've absorbed that yolk sac. There's no longer any extra food source around except what they can start to find. So they're going to get out and be led by the hen looking for that food. And I do know people who've sat on the wood duck boxes and nests and get out there early in the morning and just within a few days hoping to see that and get a picture or be able to observe it. But it's a very short-lived event. I mean, once they get up, they're gone.
They're gone. Yeah, there you go. Alec, you got lucky. You got lucky there. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good luck this year.
We have Lois in DeForest next. Hi, Lois.
Hi, Larry and Bill. My comment is that my son and I, just 1 year ago, found a house finch.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fluttering, and were able to capture it. The Dane County Humane Society had diagnosed her with conjunctivitis.
Which is an eye disease, yes.
Yes, uh-huh, and it's very contagious. And
correct.
So they treated her and released her in my neighborhood, mm-hmm, they would have released, let me help with the release, except I wasn't reading my emails often enough. And so a volunteer did bring her out to DeForest, to the Western Green Park, to release her near my house. At any rate, the reason for my wanting to tell you about this is for other listeners that I was advised to clean my feeder so that yes. other birds wouldn't get this disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, the conjunctivitis, as we said, is an eye infection, and you'll see kind of a crusting around the eye, a swelling, and eventually it may lead to an actual blindness, and that's where the birds, it doesn't kill them, but it'll debilitate them so much that they're not able to really feed effectively. And as you say, it can be spread around a feeder, especially the tube-type feeders, where the birds have to reach in to pull the seed out, so the Niger seed is common. So the belief is that as they're reaching in there, their little eyelashes will brush along that and pick up the disease, and with that be passed around. So yeah, you want to keep your feeders clean, and it's not just conjunctivitis, but also with the seed on the ground, the bird droppings accumulate, and if you get a sick bird in there, there's a chance to start an epidemic of salmonella. That's another one. So my suggestion has always been during the wintertime periodically, and especially if you feed in summertime where it gets warmer, more humid, and these things, pathogens grow a lot more rapidly, every so often when you fill your feeder, you see that it's empty, bring it in, put it in warm water with a little bit of bleach solution, let it soak, disinfect that, so rinse it off and dry completely, and then start all over again. And then for the accumulated seed under a feeder, you may want to occasionally rake that up because you've got birds that are feeding in where other bird droppings may accumulate. And it's kind of like letting a sick child go to school with the flu. Yeah. You're starting a bit of an epidemic. And that's the last thing we want to do. We want to enjoy the birds, bring them in and help them, not to expose them to a possible epidemic right at your feeders.
There you go. Thank you so much, Lois, for calling. Appreciate it. Stephen Lafarge has something for us. Hi, Steve.
Hey, guys. I'm really appreciating the show, especially the bird calls. As I've been sitting here on hold, I'm listening to Drink Your Tea, which is a rufous-sided towhee, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's right, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the reason I'm calling is I've been watching the weather and waiting for the warm snap and waiting on the Orioles to come back. And
aren't we all?
Well, I was reminded, it seems every year we run into empty shelves when it comes to getting the grape jelly. And it's always seemed to be a big fuss with the packaging and the mess and the scooping it out, and it's always left.
Mm-hmm.
So I started kind of hacking, a little life hack that I applied to the grape jelly feeding. I just took a utility knife and started cutting the plastic jars in half and then setting out one half at a time. They didn't seem to care. But that worked great until the shelves emptied.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself in the grocery store looking around for an alternative, and I stopped in the Jell-O aisle. And it turns out they don't care. You could feed them grape Jell-O, orange Jell-O, strawberry, cherry, and that was nice. I just started making Jell-O and putting it in Pyrex custard cups. And then I started.
Oh, got a real chef here.
Yeah, I started stretching it. You add a little extra sugar, maybe some fruit juice concentrate if I had some left over. And they didn't mind once they were coming to the feeder, and it works great. I mean, it's really slick, and there's less packaging, less plastic waste. I even caught woodpeckers of all things, downy woodpecker in some strawberry Jell-O mix that I had made. It really blew me away. But I thought I'd share that with folks as an alternative to feeding the grape jelly, mm-hmm. and especially when the shelves start clearing out. But once folks get into it and start, pouring up batches into a custard cups that you can set out like one at a time as needed, you can have the other ones just waiting in the fridge. It really works out slick.
I like that idea.
Yeah, great.
Steve.
Good
Thank
for you.
You very
yeah, nice
much.
To experiment with it. And one thing with the jelly or putting out the orange halves is it seems to be a little bit of an individual taste. Not all the Orioles are attracted to it. I haven't always had the best of luck. I've had other people tell me they can't keep up with it. So it seems to be some of them maybe acquire a sweet tooth for that or an appetite for the jelly and the oranges. Put it out there. Give it a try. I've always mentioned that if you want a variety of birds, offer a variety of food.
Yeah.
So start with that. Experiment. See what they go for. And as you mentioned, even downy woodpecker coming in. I had a downy woodpecker at my hummingbird feeder last year. Not typical, but this one guy found it, happened to like it, and you never know, you know, what's going to happen out there.
Yeah, and my Oriole feeder has both the orange, you can put the orange slices and the grape jelly on the same feeder, so.
Sometimes well, like the buffet.
It's the buffet a little line. Buffet. Yeah, a little buffet there. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Oh, I see somebody here. Russ from Stoughton said, yeah, Russ, woodpecker well, drinking like, out of a feeder.
Yeah, yeah. Russ, hi.
Hi, hello. I sort of had the same observation starting about 4 years ago with downy back woodpeckers hitting up the Oriole feeders. I think the holes are too small on the hummingbird feeders, but whereas the Orioles might take 3, 4, 5 sips, the hummingbirds will, I mean, the downy back woodpeckers will sit there for 3, 4 minutes.
Yeah, they'll really hit them. Yeah, funny, we were just talking about it, and you've got the same experience. So it's not completely out of the realm that woodpeckers will go to the Oriole feeders.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks.
I wouldn't expect it to happen, but yeah.
We were talking about towhees a minute ago, and I think, Dave, you've got...
Just like they mentioned, drink your tea.
Yeah.
Easy to remember that way.
Yeah.
A little warble at the end. Yeah. Drink your tea.
That's perfect.
So, yeah. Nice little phrase. That should be easy. And this is a good one to remember the song for because they really love the thickets. And you'll hear, it's a good-sized bird.
Yeah.
But almost the size of a robin. You'll hear them, but you may not see them if they're hiding in the dense shrubbery. But that song will carry.
Yeah.
And I had one just show up in the last week or so around my neighborhood. And, always fun to hear them.
Yeah.
It's a real sign of
spring. Drink your tea. Yeah. There you go. Well, let's take another call. Where are we? Kate in Wausau? I think it's your turn. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I've learned a lot. I have a do-no-harm sort of question.
Mm-hmm.
We have some hunting land, and we put up bluebird feeders, and they're about houses, not feeders,
yep. Mm-hmm.
About 5 feet off the ground on a PVC pole. And the last couple of years, every time there are babies in there, we think that there are babies in there, a bear comes and eats all the babies and smashes the house.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I mean, are we doing more harm than good since the bear knows where to find them?
Sounds like the bear is actually kind of cued in on that as a food source. And that's, again, an individual learning that one bear just recognized that bluebird houses seem to offer something for it. That's a real challenge for people in central northern Wisconsin where you're in bear country. Bird feeders, you can't just put them out there in your backyard. They will destroy those. So you've got to either take them down or hang them a little bit higher and differently. And this is a little unusual. First time I've heard of them going after bluebird houses. But obviously you've got one that's got a bit of a habit there.
Yeah, I would not put it up this year.
Yeah, if he's kind of cued in on that, yeah, there's no sense luring in a pair of bluebirds just to feed the black bear.
Yeah, and maybe after a year he will learn to go somewhere else.
If there's some way that you could try to rig that so that rather than the house being on a post and just, say, 5 feet high, suspend that from a limb, make sure it's not just swinging around in the wind or something, but see if you can't do that to kind of bear-proof it, get it out of his reach, but make it accessible for the bird. Now, that's going to take a little more engineering.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for calling, Kate. Appreciate it. Dave in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. A couple of years ago, it was common to see little families of 8 or 10 little ducks or geese in the marsh here. But last year, we had high water 4 times, and we'd only see 1 or 2 babies. And this year, the water's even higher. It's been, above flood level for weeks.
Oh, sure, definitely.
That's going to cut into the duck and goose populations and all the bottomland splitting?
It certainly can. Now, especially for Canada geese, because they're pretty early nesters. On my way down today, I stopped at Horicon Marsh, and I came across four broods of Canada geese. They were all 1.5 to 3 days old. So they're just coming out now. Usually the last week of April, I start to see the first ones for southern Wisconsin. First week of May, they really start popping, which means they have a 28-day incubation. So we're going back a full month when they laid those eggs. Well, at that time, they may have found an area that was high and dry, and then the floods came. If that water hits those eggs, that cold temperature will chill that embryo and basically kill it. So, yeah, for birds that did lay their eggs where it is somewhat flood-prone, that certainly will wipe out the chance for raising any young from that family. And for geese in particular, they don't usually re-nest where mallards certainly will. They'll try again. Yeah, they'll try a second and even a third time. And speaking of mallards, when I drove past Horicon today, I came across a picked cornfield from last fall. There were about 30, 35 drake mallards out in that field feeding. And then I did see one hen flying with a couple of drakes behind her. Why are all the drakes out there? Because all the hens are on the nest. Their job is done for the year, except for the mallard that loses its nest. Now she's going to be mobbed by every drake in the neighborhood for a second mating attempt. But right now they're incubating. That's why the drakes are all hanging out.
There we go. Let's take another call. Bob, I'm not sure where you're from. Let's say a question about eagles, I believe.
Yeah, Larry.
Yeah.
I've seen some eagles in the Madison area, some prairie area, and I'm wondering, do they stay in one place all year round, or do they migrate? I guess they must need open water, but is there open water around Sun Prairie or Madison area, or do they go maybe to Prairie du Sac in the winter, or what goes on with eagles?
Yeah, good question. Yes, there is migration. Obviously, fish is a big food source for them, though they will also scavenge. But the Eagle Days, Sauk City, Prairie du Sac, well, that's below the dam on the Wisconsin River where you have open water. And, of course, the best eagle watching in January is the coldest winters because most of the river is frozen up and you just have that little bit of open water. Also, some of the dams and spillways on the Mississippi River. We find also a lot of our eagles go down to Missouri. So, in other words, they've got to get down past that ice line or find open water. So that's where they're winter, and they're pretty early migrant to come back to the nesting sites, and a lot of them are on the nest right now and raising young. Yep.
There we go. Thank you so much for that call, Bob. Jane wondered about the color changes in goldfinches over the season. Does the color change a lot?
Dramatically. And a lot of people who are just beginning watching birds in their backyard will oftentimes ask me, what happened to all the goldfinches in winter? They turn such a gray, dull olive, it looks like two different birds. But if you watch them, especially those first 3 weeks in April or so, they change. Right now, they should almost all be into the full golden yellow color. And it takes a couple of weeks' time. It's always dramatic to watch that in early spring, one of the early signs.
So someone sent in a photo a while back, not too long ago, of probably 20 goldfinches, and they were all just that bright gold color.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Really, really pretty.
They've got their colors now.
Bill, thank you so much. I want to just mention again, your book is Journey of a Thousand Lifers. And get it by going
on my website, BillVolkert.com.
BillVolkert.com.
Hey, contact me there, and I'll get one in the mail.
Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, I had a great time with it. Always enjoy it. Thanks so much, Larry, and everyone else.
Bill is a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years and over 40 years of bird watching. Great to have him along. Tomorrow, it's Garden Talk time. Susan Carpenter from the UW Arboretum will be with us to talk about native plant gardening, so I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.